We are 4 months into the war in Ukraine, and the people and the media are losing interest in the story. Today, we're going to talk about American interest in foreign affairs, as well as the media and why it matters on The Public Diplomat. Let's do it. Hey, guy.
Howdy.
Right. So I wrote my dissertation, 20 years ago. And the topic of the dissertation was what makes international events newsworthy. And what I did in my extensive research and literature review is I tried to discover why some nations get tons of coverage while the majority of nations out there get minimal to none. There are 195 nations in the world, 197, it depends on the day. We have a lot of new countries every single day. And guess what? What the research shows and indicates is that every single year, seven nations, maybe 10, dominate 90% of American media coverage, where the rest of the world gets zero to none. So if you are Germany, China, Russia, Israel, you're in luck. But guess what? If you're everybody else, you're not newsworthy for American broadcasters unless you go to war with the United States, like, Grenada, Panama back in the day, right? Yugoslavia back in the day, Vietnam. Or if there's a major natural disaster, somebody wins, Miss Universe, or you win the World Cup. Why does this matter? This matters because Americans pretty much have a very low diet of foreign news coverage, and this trickles down to attitudes. Now, there's a real question here, and that is, do American broadcasters not cover the world because Americans are not interested in learning about the world, or are Americans just simply not interested in the world and therefore the media doesn't cover it? So, Guy, you are a historian. Are Americans isolationists by nature?
So if you're asking by nature, literally, about nature, then I can point to that by nature, the United States is an island, and island nations have the luxury of feeling secure and separate from what's going on elsewhere.
I'm not sure if Taiwan would agree, but yeah.
Well, no, that's exactly it. So we can argue about whether their sense of security is a false sense of security or not. But when you look at the United States, Japan, England, Australia, it's definitely there. Now, granted, of course, the bigger, richer the island, the more secure the nation might feel. But I have a colleague, Mike Campbell, proper attribution, who always points out that God protects drunks, fools, and the United States of America. And so in this respect, the protection that God granted the United States of America comes in the form of two huge oceans that surround us like a giant moat. And there's a famous, the most famous document of American isolationism is George Washington's farewell address, in which he warns, it's very famous, he warns Americans against foreign entanglements, against permanent alliances and permanent rivalries. And what he's referring to when he's urging Americans to remain aloof from foreign affairs, especially European, what he's referring to is the fact that the United States is separated by these oceans. Okay, so this insularity to Washington meant that the world's wars are the world's wars, not America's wars. And there's another famous historical document of by another American president, John Quincy Adams, in the 19th century, also highlighting the same policy, and again referring to this insularity, separateness, and he talks about how explains that Americans are not in the habit of going abroad, or shouldn't be in the habit of going abroad, to liberate other people, to get involved in their wars of liberation, in the sense that Americans wish them well in their fight for liberty and independence, but America does not go abroad, as he said, in search of monsters to destroy. Those wars are their wars, not ours. And so again, being an island, insulated and isolated, is a natural factor that produces isolationism. The second natural element or factor is that the United States is a huge country, unlike other island nations. And so I'd like to point out, as a you know, that even though this episode of ours is about foreign news or foreign issues, that domestic news also is very insular in the United States. Okay, so you and I are in Texas. We don't hear about what's happening in Minnesota or California or New York unless, like you said, there's a major natural disaster or some sort of great big battles, you know, some sort of violent demonstration or violent crime. The only thing we hear about here in our locality are things from our town, our capital city, you know, our government in Texas, or our government in Washington. Those are the only things that intrude on our news, because those are the only things that intrude on our lives, because we're a huge country, naturally.
Okay, so I mean, it almost comes down to relevance, right? And it's one of the main determinants of international news coverage from the research that I've conducted, right? If something is relevant to me, I'm going to care about it. If it's not relevant to me, I'm not going to care about it. And I want to put
relevant in terms of affecting your life rather than
affecting
just
my life. Yeah, obtrusive. Will this impact how I'm going to take my kids to school today, or my plans for the weekend, or my work schedule, and so forth? I want to put it up on the screen, and for those of you on the podcast, you can listen along. And just some data from the Pew Research Center. This is a survey conducted in May 2022, so relatively recent, but these are these are longitudinal surveys, so they're rather consistent in terms of data. And the question is, how much do you agree or disagree with the following statements? And to the statement that says we should pay less attention to problems overseas and concentrate on problems here at home, what we see in the Pew research is that 51% of those asked agreed with that statement. So this is a truly isolationist sentiment, right? We should pay less attention to things happening overseas and much more attention to things happening at home. Put the focus here. And this goes beyond gender. It goes beyond age. It goes beyond political leaning, with differences, right? When we really look at it. So if you look at the chart on the screen right now, you will see that older people are more likely to think that it's best for our future for a country to be involved or active in foreign affairs, while younger people don't share that sentiment as much. And we see that liberals are more on the globalization side, or in conservatives a little bit more on the isolation side. Guy, any thoughts about these figures as we see on the screen?
Look, there's it's a historical tension in American domestic politics about the role that the United States should take in the world. And it's like you said, it's a consistent theme or trait of American domestic politics that Americans are resistant to getting involved in or to intervening in foreign affairs. And it's reflected, to your original question about the news, it's reflected in how much attention they pay to foreign news.
You mean the media or the audiences?
Well, again, it's a belief system that the media of commerce in general, that producers cater to the interests of consumers, and so I'm assuming that the media follows the people. But I know that there's a contrary assumption about commerce, that actually producers create demand. But again, that's a belief system.
Well, let's ask a different question, and let's ask why this is important, right? Why is it important whether or not Americans are interested in foreign affairs? Well, I mean, why should they care?
Yeah. So look, there's a first of all, the question is definitely the defining. It's usually unspoken. So I congratulate you for speaking it. But it's you when isolationism or this impulse is discussed, it's usually presented as a problem that we need to overcome, okay, to fix.
So in other words, the problem is framed as a domestic problem on the international level.
Exactly. Right? Okay, that here we have these Americans who don't want to get involved in things that they think are none of their business. And actually, again, it's whether it's foreign business to me in Azerbaijan or in Minnesota, just far away from me. And so the question, like you said, is why is it that having a population that thinks it shouldn't stick its nose in other people's business, why is that presented as a pathology? And as far as I can see it, and look, you're probably better positioned to say, I think two arguments, again, in a kind of an unspoken way, are suggested as to why it's a problem that needs to be fixed. One is American decline, okay, that if we don't care about our role in the world, if we retreat from the role of the world, then America will decline around the globe. And the other is if the U.S. doesn't get involved in the world, the world will fall apart. If the U.S. is an isolationist, then we have World War I, then we have World War II, then we have the Holocaust, then we have, I don't know, global warming, whatever. So I think those are the two. Again, they're not usually articulated, but I think those are the two things in the background that are presented. That somebody who says it's a problem, I think that's what they're gearing towards.
Well, and let's point to another paradox in international relations. You know, there's so much criticism of the United States for its involvement all around the world, right? And you can hear critics, you know, all around. I mean, just go on my Twitter and you'll see so many people attacking the United States for their involvement in different parts of the world. And yet at the same time, when there is a major crisis, humanitarian crisis, right? In Somalia, we saw this. We saw this in Kosovo and the former Yugoslavia. We saw this in Libya. We see it all around the world, or even in Corona, right? Where people all around the world are like, United States, please step in with your resources, your military and economic might, and help us solve problems, right? Yeah. And when the United States doesn't do it, they're being accused of not caring. And when they do it, they get accused of, sticking their nose in something where they don't belong. And we saw this, again, the Somalian example is such a wonderful example, right? In Somalia, there was chaos, there was civil war, warlords, all of that. The United States stepped in to help. The American administration really thought that they're going to get favor in terms of public opinion. And just, you know, a little later, we had blackout down. Right. No. So going back, you know, whether the United States is going to get involved or not requires the support of the people, of the American people. And when the American people are having isolationist views, such as right after World War I, right, that was really the peak of isolationism in the United States.
I would say before World War I, and then again, it's basically Americans voted Wilson into office because he promised not to get us into World War I. So it shows that the isolationist impulse was strong before World War I and remained strong after World War I. It's just that the president who rode into office on the isolationist agenda turned out to have been disingenuous.
But listen, is that really surprising for politicians? I don't think many politicians would pass that test of keeping campaign promises. It's called reality, right? I mean, and this is a case where American involvement. I mean, look, we're Israelis, we're Jews, we're, you know, children and families of Holocaust survivors. If it wasn't for the United States stepping in, despite public opinion, despite American isolationism, right, despite the will to heed to John Quincy Adams' sentiment or George Washington's, right, the United States, in my belief, saved the Western world. So sometimes it is very important to step in, and sometimes it is important for politicians to convince their citizens that despite their lack of interest, it should be interested. So this is where I want to take it. This is
But
what
wait,
I want to talk. Okay.
before you go,
Okay.
Two things. First of all, you said convince. In both of those cases, the politicians did not convince. They lied, or you know, they made promise A and did something else. So they didn't convince. They took the vote of the people for policy A and pursued policy B. So they didn't convince. But the other is about this, you know, saving the world, preventing the Holocaust, etc. Look, the concern about, I said, you know, American decline and concern about a disaster happening that only the United States can stop. The first, about American decline, most Americans, the decline that they care about is the decline of America domestically, not the decline of America's role in the world. Okay, but to the point about the, preventing the Holocaust or World War II, or defeating the Nazis, then yes, there's no doubt that any isolationist will concede that yes, it's certainly good for Europeans, or for European Jews, or for others, that the Nazis were defeated. Okay? The question is whether it's good for, 400,000 Americans died in World War II. Okay? Did that help their families? You know, was that sacrifice worth it? And your point was about you and I being Israeli is a relevant one, okay? Because it is easy for Israeli families to answer the same question. The soldier on the front lines is protecting his children, his parents, his brothers and sisters, his neighbors. Okay, and the same goes today for the Ukrainian fighter on the front lines against the Russians. Okay, but can you honestly say that American soldiers going off to fight in Europe in World War I or World War II or in Syria or Iraq or Vietnam or Korea is protecting his parents and his children and his neighbors? Okay, so I think that's why Americans are so naturally, again, your question, naturally isolationist, because it really is a challenge to make the case that Americans should sacrifice their children's lives or their tax dollars in other countries, whereas other countries, it's an easier case to make. You don't have to be some sort of, it's not a conceptual thing. You can see it with your own eyes that you sending your child to the front lines to maybe die is saving your other children at home. Americans, it's hard for them to understand this.
So this is exactly the challenge facing American leaders, right? Because whenever it was time to rally around the flag for the American people, and let's take more modern examples. I mean, in Vietnam, it was to stop communism and the spread of communism in Asia. I mean, in Korea, we had a similar narrative. And then we had, so we had the Cold War, but then we had the post-Cold War wars, whether it was in Iraq with Desert Storm, number one, George H. Bush, right? How many people could identify Kuwait on a map in 1990, right? Mm-hmm. Not too many, right? I mean, how many could even identify Iraq on the map? Not too many. And yet there is a need to galvanize American public opinion to say, ladies and gentlemen, Saddam Hussein, which again, the folks sitting in Iowa and in most, you know, in their living room, wherever around the Midwest, the South, the West, Northwest, wherever it is, they never heard of Saddam Hussein. So now you have to explain to folks who don't consume foreign news why they should, as you said, not only support increasing taxes or give the US dollars to, but also have their children go to war to fight in a foreign nation they probably never heard of. And really thinking about everything happening now with Russia, with Crimea a year or two ago, with Ukraine right now, with Georgia during the Obama administration, this is a real challenge. And, you know, I think in a way, after the war in Afghanistan and the second war in Iraq, where we were told we need to go there to stop weapons of mass destruction, which we found out was a big lie fed to us. At that point, not only do Americans lose interest in foreign affairs, so do our politicians. Many people like to speak about Donald Trump and American first, but I think one could easily argue that Barack Obama himself didn't have a large appetite for foreign intervention. Yeah. And we saw this in Syria.
Yeah, look, it's not the politicians. The politicians, again, just like about the media companies. The media companies do what the viewers tell them to do. Same goes for the politicians. Okay? If Barack Obama's constituency was gung-ho to volunteer to go to the army or to volunteer their children to the army, he would have done it. Okay? But they didn't. Okay? So it's not. So Barack Obama and Donald Trump are both symptoms or reflections of the American people. And so when you're examining how do leaders get their constituents in Iowa interested in what's going on in some far-off country like Iraq, historically, in the last century or more, we've seen two methods. Okay, and I'm not saying methods as if they're cynical. They're sincere and they believe what they're presenting to us. They, the politicians, and they, the advocates. But one is a humanitarian message. Okay, so using the news media to bombard Americans with heartbreaking stories and images, just like we do in the, just like the, our charities do, our foreign charities, you know, help starving children in where Africa, etc. The same thing we do with our governments do, only instead of sending money or doctors or teachers to these countries that are going through a humanitarian crisis, the advocacy is to send soldiers to fix the problem. That's like you said about George Bush Sr., what he did in Somalia, Bill Clinton in Yugoslavia, and Obama in Libya. And it's how Wilson tried to drum up American public opinion for World War I by with the Lusitania, showing again all those poor victims. But a much more, so it's a humanitarian appeal, and it is effective, but not very effective. The more effective way is to demonstrate to people that if we don't intervene there, the war will come to your house, to your neighborhood, etc. And that's when you look at the Mexican-American War, the Spanish-American War, World War II, the Cold War definitely, the Second Iraq War. The message was that, and again, I'm not saying that they're lying about, you know, I'm convinced that they're not lying. They believed in the domino theory, that if we don't fight them there, missiles will come here. They believed in weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And I'm sure that Wilson and FDR believed also that if we don't save democracy in Europe, then somehow democracy in America will somehow be diminished or something. I'm not a cynic, but what I think these instances highlight is that it's not that politicians are liars, but that Americans cannot be convinced to go to war unless they come to believe that the war is going to come home here, and that by going abroad to slay monsters, we're in fact protecting our homes and neighbors and families and et cetera.
And think about something really interesting. So during the Cold War, it was a very easy argument to make, right? We have the great Soviet, right? The Empire of Evil, as Ronald Reagan called them, right?
And missiles.
Yeah, they have nuclear missiles. And you know, it started on Korea and Vietnam, but, you know, just a few years later, decades later, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? And the same, the next kind of similar paradigm is with post 9/11, where the new enemy was the jihad, the global jihadist movement, starting with Al Qaeda and then with Daesh, with ISIS, right? Where, you know, yes, this is happening in Syria, in Iraq, in Northern Africa, and Yemen, but we saw what happens if we stay away with this. Like Bill Clinton kind of ignored it, you know, during the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania, and, you know, then 9/11 occurred, right? So the United States, the real question, it goes back to, you know, in this world that is supposedly flat, like, you know, Tom Friedman told us from the New York Times,
let's not start with Tom Friedman.
Well, listen, the question ultimately is, are there any islands in this highly globalized, highly interactive world?
Yeah. So look, I want to take a few minutes to
take it away. Yep.
To give you a little ancient history that is very relevant to people. You're in my age and the age of our viewers, but I've since learned that it's completely lost on my students, because they're too young. You know, 9/11 is not something that happened, it's something that they read about in a history book to them. So we know, you and I know, that that 9/11, this the war coming home to America, kind of created this interventionist spike against the isolationist trend to go and intervene abroad and fix problems in order to, again, to prevent the war from coming to us. When I teach my class on Roman military history, you can see the same debate, and it's not just kind of in the ether. They had these debates literally in the Senate, just like we had in our Congress, about whether Rome should focus on Italian security and protect Italy on the shores of Italy, or whether it should set up provinces elsewhere in the Mediterranean, in Greece, in Sicily, Spain, in order to protect the Italian shoreline starting abroad. And what prompted this was Hannibal's invasion. Okay, and I tried to, again, this is what my students will never understand, the sense of insecurity that Americans felt for 1 hour and 3,000 dead on September 11th, the Romans felt for, 16 years or so. And the death toll, basically, they suffered a 9/11 virtually every day for 16 years. Okay, and so the imperialism that followed Hannibal's invasion is understandable. I think we of the 9/11 generation, we can understand it better than others because we had a tiny Hannibal's invasion and we went all over the world to protect ourselves as we understood it. And so that kind of puts the Roman imperialism in context as part of the same debate about, they were also isolationist. And it's this vulnerability that opened, that converted them to interventionists.
Okay, so right now the Biden administration is trying to figure out what to do with Ukraine, I don't foresee any American soldiers going to battle in the outskirts of Kiev or Mariupol or anywhere else in the Ukrainian battlefield. However, the American administration should or does have a domestic debate about budgets and how much money to give in terms of military support to the Ukrainians, how involved we want to be with NATO in case there is a further escalation on the Eastern European borders, Poland, Belarus, you know, that geopolitical front. We're talking about now Finland and Sweden joining NATO and so forth. And American, also the administration has to think about refugees, right? In Europe, when there was the war in Syria, Angela Merkel pretty much forced every single European nation to absorb a large number of refugees from Syria and from all over the Middle East. This sentiment is not as popular amongst the American people and American politicians. There are a few in the Democratic Party. They're calling upon the Biden administration to bring in refugees from Ukraine. Right now, we don't hear too much about this in the media or from our politicians either.
Yeah. So how does, I mean, if there is this way, I don't know if to call it a wave, but a kind of an isolationist sentiment, tendency. You showed that poll before about Republicans and Democrats, but even among Democrats, like we said earlier, there's not this great push among even Democrats to, the electorate, not the strategists, to get involved heavily in the war in Ukraine or elsewhere. So my question to you, since you're the media guy, how does, we clearly have seen governments use the media to, use the media to effectively convince people to, Americans who are naturally resistant, to get interventionist. And we've seen governments fail to do that through the media. So what makes a successful media blitz to convince Americans, and what makes some campaigns succeed and others fail?
Well, it's a great question. Obviously, you know, if it's something that's super relevant, right? 9/11, I think, you know, the dealing with, you know, American assets being endangered anywhere in the world, that's a clear, right? I mean, that's easy. Right. The people always rally around their flag when attacked, right? So if the United States embassy is bombed, attacked anywhere, you know, we saw this in Iran, we saw it in Africa with the ISIS attack, sorry, with the Al-Qaeda attacks. Yeah, I mean, Americans will rally around the flag. But, you know, if the Biden administration will want us to get involved in, you know, Batswana or Kyrgyzstan or Bolivia, you know, most Americans will kind of look around, scratch their head and say, where is this on the map? I'm not exactly sure. It's not because Americans are necessarily ignorant of foreign affairs. As we said, they're just not really interested in it. So if politicians cannot clearly articulate American interest, their chances of getting support from the public and to have the news media really rally around their narrative is not very high, right?
But take, for example, the first Iraq war. Okay, you know, the Iraqis didn't attack us. Okay, so it wasn't like the weapons of mass destruction where you could tell Americans, rightly or wrongly, it doesn't matter now, that they're under threat. There was a successful campaign to make Americans care about Kuwait or World War II. Okay? Japan attacked us, and we're going to get involved heavily in a war against Germany that didn't attack us. Okay, so what were they? What were those administrations able to do media-wise that other governments, even though they wanted to get involved, to get the public involved, failed to do?
Okay. Well, let's only look at Kuwait right now as a case study, and let's talk about two main differences between Kuwait and today's reality. First of all, during the times of the Kuwait War, we had CNN, and they were, you know, their ratings were through the roof of foreign affairs, right? The CNN effect we read so much about for so many years. Guess what? Nobody's watching CNN anymore, right? I mean, the fragmentation of the media landscape is one key difference today, right? So whereas, you know, in the days of Walter Cronkite or in the early 1990s or late 80s, we really had ABC, CBS, and NBC, and maybe then CNN dominated the news cycle and they could really, you know, influence the narrative. Today, you know, nobody's watching the same show anymore, right? Republicans are watching right-wing media, Democrats are watching left-wing media, and anybody under the age of 30 is on TikTok. So, you know, that's one big key difference between Kuwait and today.
So that in order to send a message, you'd have to send literally 100,000 message on 100,000 platforms?
Well, back then it was much easier, right? If you had the support of the editorial staff of the New York Times, ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN, you had 80% of the audience. Yeah. Now those networks, right? ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN, they have, their ratings are so low compared to other channels, they don't really, you know, they matter much less than they used to, yeah. Right? Second thing is duration. So let's compare the first Iraq war to the second Iraq war. The first Iraq war, in terms of public opinion, was beautiful, right? We went in, we kicked ass, and we won, and we withdrew from Iraq, right? So it was easy, it was good, not too many Americans got hurt. It made us all feel very patriotic, very proud. It was all great. But look what happened during the second war in Iraq, right? The first couple of days, same thing as Kuwait. We come in, we kick ass.
And high support across the political spectrum.
High support, even in Europe, in the early parts of the war, we had high support. But then when we became the policemen of Iraq and we got involved in domestic politics between the Shiites and Sunnis and Kurds, and this could be a different episode, then, you know, that's when things became, you know, much worse. Americans began to die, left and right, coalition soldiers, and this is where public opinion tanked. And media coverage not only was not favorable anymore, it was rather unfavorable for George Bush. All right, guys, so let's summarize this episode with a couple of key thoughts, key takeaways. First of all, Americans are by nature, by default, isolationists in terms of international affairs, right? They don't want to get involved internationally. You mentioned several reasons. Second tidbit is Americans, because of this, are not really interested in the world, and therefore the news media doesn't really cover the world in a meaningful manner. And this really, I want to pose this question to anybody on our YouTube channel and our podcast on Apple and Spotify and all the others. Here's a question for you for the comment section. Where do you get quality news about foreign affairs? Where do you go to for, if something happens today in the world, who do you turn to for in-depth analysis of geopolitical matters besides the public diplomat, right? Where do you go? I'm really curious to know this answer. I personally have to collect data from about 10 different media outlets from all around the world to get a full picture. Guy, do you have a source you highly trust?
Well, I'll confess to being one of those Americans who are not that interested in foreign affairs. Like I care about foreign affairs to the degree that they affect, that they're part of American politics, but I have my, a few countries that I have family in, and therefore they're more personal to me, but.
So again, to the relevance hypothesis. Yeah. Okay, third thing we're taking away is that this matters. This matters because American administrations, and you cannot, even though you're an historian, you cannot point to a single administration who had zero involvement around the world. If you do, you get a free ice cream. If anybody in the comment section does it, you'll get a free Starbucks card from me. Whether you're Donald Trump or Barack Obama, who said, we don't want to get involved, right? Or Wilson, whoever it is. Ultimately, American administrations get us involved in different parts of the world because it's called reality. International relations involve every single nation. And you cannot truly be an island, whether it's corona, whether it's trade, whether it's security or counterterrorism. You can't be 100% disconnected from the rest of the world. This is something, it's a bigger conversation, Guy. I think this is a perfect place to end. So I want to thank everybody again for listening to our show, watching us here on YouTube, listening to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, all the rest. Please subscribe, give likes, shares, and comments. We appreciate your time and effort every single time. Guy, have a great day. And everybody, thank you very much. And